Good morning, everybody. Robin Ayoub here from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording. Today's episode 254. We are recording episode 254 today, and thanks for joining me on this conversation and this journey of our dialogue today. My guest of honor today is Shaheen Samavati, and Shaheen is the CEO and founder of a company called Vera Content. Based in Madrid. And Shaheen's not her first time on the channel. That's her second time. Last time we spoke on the channel here was October 2024, if I remember. I was just looking at our conversation from last time. I downloaded the transcript of that one, and we're going over a few things. Today's conversation is to bring us a step further in our conversation we started in 2024. What has changed? Obviously, many things have changed, and we'll touch on that in during our conversation. Just a little bit of a context about Vera Content. As I mentioned, they are based in Madrid. It's a multilingual marketing agency that Shaheen built from scratch, and this came out of frustration. I remember from our conversation last time, she couldn't find suppliers that met her own editorial standards when she was on the client side. And we've interviewed a few people on the channel from the client side, and most client side have shared some of that frustration from various angles as when it comes to dealing with the language industry. So this is where this company was founded from. And that founding story, personally, I respect enormously. Since last we spoke last with Shaheen, the AI conversation has taken quite the dramatic speed, I would say. It has, from a content perspective, it's moving very fast. The question of what localization even means today is getting louder. And I'm genuinely curious, to be honest with you, Shaheen, to answer the question, translation versus creation, I guess, content in the target language. And that conversation is shifting quite a bit, I'm imagining. We'll wait to hear what you have to say, because the conversation on my side has shifted, to be honest with you. I'm seeing, you know, this is episode 254. We've interviewed, you know, countless executives on this channel, and the message is pretty common. Things are shifting, no debate on that one. Are we shifting as a human? Who operating in various technologies, various industries, are we matching that shift? So without any further ado, welcome back to the conversation, Shaheen. Good to see you again. And I'm happy that you're joining me today. So welcome back. Good to see you.
Believe it's been 2 years, almost 2 years already. Now that you just—I just realized that when you told me, it seemed like a few months ago.
So I'm seems glad like it's yesterday.
A lot of things have happened in the industry since then. That's for sure.
So to remind the audience, if you don't mind, our first question is: you've moved from Cleveland to Madrid and built a company in a second language in a market that wasn't yours. And your whole business is about helping other brands do something similar. How much of Vera Content philosophy is actually, you know, your autobiography, I would say?
Yeah, well, I should say I'm actually based in Malaga now. We started the company in Madrid, and the company is still based there. But now I'm working remotely in the nice seaside town city of Malaga, Spain, in the south.
Yeah, the hometown of Antonio Banderas.
That's right, yeah. He's you see him around here sometimes. He's really involved in the Malaga community, and is invested in a lot of things. But yeah, it was definitely like the business directly, I guess, inspiration from my own background, coming from a background in journalism and then working in communications and marketing. As I said, being on the client side, working with vendors, and thinking I could do it better is basically how I got into it. And I definitely think like my perspective as a foreigner being in another country obviously gave me it also coming from like an editorial background, like gave me that different perspective in terms of like, I don't know, being able to see the need that was there and having like an idea of how I could solve it like differently. So yeah, definitely.
And when Shaheen mentioned her background, so she comes from journalism. You're a business journalist, right? So last time we spoke, and the journalism, you know, that editorial thing keeps coming up in our conversation. So, and you being on the client side, not finding what you needed. You've been running Vera Content now for close to a decade. When you look back at the founding frustration, the editorial standard gap. Is this still the same gap today, or the problem has been solved already or evolved?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been totally solved. I think there's, we definitely have plenty of competition in the market, and there's others who also do the job very well. But I think you still see, variations in that. What did I want to say? I wanted to say that, actually coming from Cleveland in Ohio, I mean, I only spoke one language when I came to Spain. So, and I learned Spanish after living here. And I've also learned a bit of other languages being in Europe. So, and it was that change to working in that multilingual context. That is what made me what made me realize what a need there was first for English content, because that's where I started. That's my background is doing editorial in English and doing that for these international companies. Because everyone needed a lot of English content, and they still do. But then seeing how that need existed as well in other languages and building that team to be able to produce the same quality that we did in English in the other languages. And that was kind of the key to what the solution we were providing.
Now, when you were in those roles, the comm roles that you were in for multinational before 2016, do you have any examples of, the worst example that you saw that was that maybe technically translated but completely missed the mark, and it sort of created that pivotal moment in the transformation from your side?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't anything.
It wasn't probably one major thing. It was little things, right? Yeah. So they accumulate.
One company I was working in, for example. I mean, I was working on managing the web translation, so we were expanding the website into more languages, and it was just. Too literal of translations, basically. And I mean, it was hard for me to be able to tell when it's in another language, but obviously when things were translated to English, I was very picky about that. So, and things really stood out to me. That's why, basically, and I realized, I think the people managing the translations oftentimes have the same struggles. They're outsourcing those translations to others, and then the result maybe doesn't quite hit the style and tone. Basically, to do it really, really well, you have to have linguists who are super hands-on. And actually, that's something I think we do really differently in our agency, is that our clients have direct contact with the linguists. And I know that's something that is not very scalable or efficient, but if you really want quality, it's necessary to understand the client more. Of course, depending on the project and the scale of it, the level of contact they have is limited, it varies. But I think the fact that they are able to, we usually have a Slack channel set up. So if they want to ask something to someone on the team, they can, and things like that. So just taking a different approach, not the typical dispatch and get the translation back, because that's the way companies I worked in had been doing it. And I just found it wasn't hitting the mark on what I was looking for. And I know our client isn't every client, but for those who really value quality and they're the ones who come to us.
And that's not the first time I'm hearing this. I mean, I've heard this from many guests on this channel. That entire discussion around, is our localization industry, really delivering quality 100% of the time, all the time? And the answer is no. I mean, everybody can attest to that. I'm not breaking any news here. And the model has always been that, we have the way the business runs in most cases, not everybody, and obviously there are exceptions. You have the project management in-house, and then you have translators outside the organization. And these translators, of course, they're vetted. Of course, they put through evaluation of some sort to make sure that the quality is there. They know what they're doing. They know they have the expertise to do the translation. But most of the time, when the subject changes, obviously the translation has a wide variety of subjects, wide variety of content. Of course, there are specializations, but sometimes the translator receives something that they're not familiar with, and they end up with doing a translation that probably not adequate to the customer, and creates that frustration. Now, in your case, are you more specialized? Is that what we're talking about? Is your translators are specialized in the topic that they are going to do the work in?
I mean, yes, it depends on the project, but really our specialization is editorial content. So we'll do pretty much any type of editorial content on any kind of topic. And depending on how technical or specialized the topic is, we might require specialized writers for that. We do definitely, I do think like most topics can be learned, so it doesn't necessarily have to be a specialized writer or translator, but it has to be someone who's curious and who want and who stays long term on the project and really gets to know it and gets to know the brand. So I think that's the key, and that's a philosophy I have from my background as a journalist. When you're a journalist, you have to write about all kinds of things, and you're not always an expert in them, but you become an expert. You talk to other people, you learn. And a lot of the content we create is based on the client's expertise. So we have to like get to know the client, get to know the people inside the company, and kind of like transfer their expertise into the content we're creating.
So how does, for their content right now, like if you receive a project, do you receive it in English, or do they give it to you as a context basically to create in Spanish, let's say, or the other way around?
The vast majority of our projects are like the primary language is English, and we adapt them to other languages, but we do have exceptions to that. Like right now we're doing a project that the primary language is German, and we're adapting that into a bunch of other languages just because the client is based in Germany and their source materials are in German. We also do quite a lot of Spanish, like we're based in Spain, so we've worked with several Spanish companies. So kind of depending on what I mean, we specialize in European languages, so it's always, we mainly work with, it has to be like a major European language that we have internally on our team for us to like, for it makes sense for us to take the project, because we have to be really comfortable at creating the content in the original language before we can adapt it into the others. So.
No, I was just wondering, like, do you actually, is the content already created when it arrived to you, or do you create it?
We create the content most of the time. We have different types of projects, but yeah, we do the content creation and the localization, and we're just focused on editorial content marketing projects. So we do like end to end of like planning the content, creating the content, publishing the content in a lot of cases as well, and doing that across multiple languages. So that's why we position ourselves as like a global content marketing agency, not only a marketing localization agency, but localization is like a huge part of what we do.
Now, I noticed that you're hiring an SEO specialist for Swiss company. Wondering, like last time we spoke, I think it was you had 14 employees internally, and in how's that going? Where are you now in 2026? Do you do SEO work? And where are you with the whole geo conversation versus SEO?
Well, in terms of the company size, we're about the same size. We haven't grown the headcount, but we've grown like the number of freelancers we work with on the projects. We're trying to be more efficient, of course, now with like all of the tools and automation available. We're trying to avoid growing headcount as much as possible. But yeah, we do. What was the second part of the question?
You're hiring an SEO specialist in
Oh yeah.
Switzerland, and I was wondering if you do SEO related work, and also what do you think of geo? Are you doing anything with geo work?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so yeah, so I was gonna I think something I alluded to the last time I talked to you was that we've been shifting from doing like pure content creation, because like when we first started, we were like mainly a content creation and localization agency. We just did like the production of the content, but we've really like evolved and kind of grown up the value chain. And part of that, luckily we were already doing that. Like we already were taking on SEO projects, email marketing projects, blog management projects, like before the whole AI shift. Like we were moving in that direction. And I think that was lucky for us strategically, because we've seen like the demand for like just high volume content creation has like gone down a lot. So, and impacted by AI, like so many companies are deciding to do more and more content creation in-house, but they still need a lot of editing work, and they need a lot of guidance still on like strategy and approach, and they still need like experts in the markets to help them adapt. So we've been really focusing on the strategy services, and then also SEO and email marketing and automation. And social media as well is like a big growth area for us. But on the question about SEO, yeah, I mean, SEO and geo go hand in hand. What we've found is, I mean, a lot of the same best practices that work for SEO also work for geo. The only thing is, I'd say that overall content strategy has been impacted, because we just see like more focus on just like sales, pure like sales intent type keywords, I guess, compared to like the editorial strategy that's just like, I say like editorial strategies have gotten much more like thought leadership focused and or more like also multimedia focused, like doing more showing people on camera, more doing interviews with people or doing like really in-depth reports that's based on first-hand reporting. Like that's the kind of content we're seeing people invest more in and less in just like pure SEO content. Because basically, if you're just creating articles of general interest, like people aren't finding those anymore. but they will find you if they're searching, like if you do well on those sales intent keywords, like that's still making you show up in AI search. So yeah, I don't know if that
So it's a
answers your
bit
question.
more precise way of putting your content out versus a throw mud on the wall. I love this statement and see what sticks. Basically, as much content as you put out there for no reason, just to say I did, nobody's going to find you with that. The search engines and the keywords are becoming a lot more precise in terms of and the algorithm are matching that too, by the way.
Well, I think like the content, if you're doing it well, like that con like that SEO content is still valuable to people. It's just like not bringing you as much value because the AI the AI chat bots are stealing it basically. Like they're just like summarizing it and giving it to people and they're never getting to your website. Like it used to work if you wrote really good articles like and that were like authoritative and in your like relevant to what people were searching for, like people would come to your website, learn that you exist and maybe buy from you eventually. But that's just changed because of the AI summaries.
So one time last time we spoke, I guess we talked about Europe and, companies going to Europe from North America or somewhere else in the world. And you educated everybody on that call. And for those of you who are interested in listening to my previous conversation with Shane, you can look it up. It was recorded around October last year, 2024, sorry. You can go to the app now. We do have an app.l10nfiresidechat.com, and you can do searches by the guest name, and you can look up the last episode we did together. But nevertheless, we did talk about Europe is not one homogeneous market, and people make mistakes sometimes when they're entering certain markets. I mean, it goes both ways when European companies entering North American markets or North America. I'm using North America because I am in North America, but it could apply to anybody. Australia, New Zealand, it doesn't matter who. And companies who are outside of Europe entering Europe. Some mistakes are pretty horrendous, and I've seen a few. What is the most expensive mistake you've seen brand make by treating it like it is a homogeneous market? I'm talking about
Yeah, I mean,
you.
I think like it all comes down to your content strategy and like your business strategy, obviously, how much you want to like localize. You know, when you see like outdoor advertising, like that has to be extremely localized. Like it's sometimes localized by neighborhood, and that makes a lot of sense. But I think when it comes to online content, there are times, but I mean, we definitely still get demand from clients, and I think this strategy does make sense in some case to do like LATAM Spanish or to do just one Europe account for one account in English for several European markets. I mean, it's not ideal. It's not gonna make you, but if you are like, for example, a B2B brand who is targeting like executives who are in international companies who likely speak English, sometimes maybe it's not worth the investment to do like very localized into every local market. Like it depends on the product. But I like there's also cases where it's absolutely necessary and also where it's like a choice about how you want to be seen as a brand and you want to be seen as like understanding that local community. And for example, like we have a client who we do we manage like social media accounts for, and they decided to do separate accounts for like based on country, not only language. So like we're doing an account for the Netherlands, an account for Belgium, just because it's like related to their like if there are like local nuances that you want to get across, like related to the products that are being sold in that market, to the stores that it's available in and things like that, then it makes sense to localize further.
Now, just to give the audience a little bit more context on why this conversation is important. So I'm going to give you a bit of an example, right? So you have a company in Germany who's trying to move to do business in the North American market. They'll most likely be dealing with generally English, But maybe they will throw in Spanish for the Spanish population living in the US. And they might down the road, as the market mature in North America, they throw in probably French for our Quebec province in Canada. However, if and there's about 400 million people living between the two countries in terms of demographics between the US and Canada. If we are moving a company or a company in Europe, in North America trying to do business in Europe, just to give you a context, there's about 500 million people living in Europe. However, they have about 12 languages, maybe a dozen more languages. But the primary language between 10 to 12 languages that a company here needs to contend with. And however, you cannot say, for instance, as a company, hey, listen, you know, they all speak English or they all can read English. That's not going to cut it up. It's not going to cut it, to be honest with you. And from a marketing perspective, you have to measure all this, right? So there is a cost associated with transforming the content from one language to 12 languages. But does it make sense for you as a business now to translate to German, to Spanish, to French, to Portuguese, to Italian? And I'm just naming the top languages here. There are many other languages in the European Union. They're not necessarily those top five only. You probably have to consider the other ones. It's a decision you have to make. And it is more and more now being asked that by these communities, by these demographics, to have content in their language. They deserve to have content in their language. You're not doing a charity to anybody. You're trying to sell them. So you may as well translate or create content in those languages. Sorry, I'll get off my soapbox here in a second. But it makes a sense to me that if you are trying to commercialize a product in those regions, to at least have the content in that language. Am I correct on this one, Shane?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're doing sales in that language, you need to have content in the language too. Like, you need all the content to support your sales team. But yeah, when it comes to deciding what to localize and what not, I think it does make sense to be strategic about it, because you don't want to throw money out the window localizing things that aren't necessary. But at the same time, like, you want to, you know, meet the expectations of your audience in those markets and, yeah, be able to speak to them. So.
Now, you also run a Content Mix podcast yourself. So it's called Content Mix Podcast. And you're hosting your own show. I can't wait to get an invitation on that. I'm just winking as I say this thing. But does hosting your own show changes how you think about content strategy for clients? Do you test ideas on your own, on your own audience first?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, the podcast has been a huge source of just original insights that we use in our own content. It helps us get ideas, helps us like network and talk to people. It's super, and it's something that we recommend to a lot of our clients, especially in B2B. Like, any like interview based content is great fodder for creating that like original insight-based content that we're talking about, the thought leadership content that I think is like more important than ever.
How long have you been doing a podcast now?
Started in 2020 during the pandemic.
And how many episodes you've done so far?
Around 200 episodes.
And who do you interview?
We interview generally people who work in content marketing, so in Europe. So it's like global content marketers. Yeah.
Okay. So you're focusing on a specific topic, basically, global content marketing.
Yes. Yeah, it's all about the challenges of multilingual content and managing content at scale.
Great. So if you want a host and a guest, so I'm raising my hand here virtually.
We actually rebranded we changed the name of the podcast to The Global Marketer, by the way. So The Content Mix was the old name.
Well, the content. So what did you call it now?
The Global Marketer.
The Global Marketer. So there may be a fit. I don't know, but we'll see. So I want to go back to something you said.
We'll talk about it.
We'll talk about that one. I want to go back to something you said when we first spoke. And, you know, this is a direct quote, by the way. I can't believe I found this. There is a big difference between transforming content from one language to another and creating original content in the target language. And, you know, this line has always been rattling in my brain, because why transform a content if I can create it in another language, right? So it's been now 2 years since we've talked about this, and AI has made, you know, distinction more important or less important. So the question is, did AI make it more obvious to create content in these languages directly, or less obvious And we're still on the transformation journey, but meaning translation.
I mean, I think AI makes it a lot easier to create content than it ever was before, but it's also easy to create bad content. So, yeah, but I do think, well, that's something like I think I was alluding to earlier is like at VeraContent, we've always been a content creation and localization agency. And so like all of the linguists we work with are kind of like writers first. So they're people who have experience in content creation and writing and take like a transcreation approach to all of the translations that we do, all the localizations. So, and I think even in the age of AI that you need those kind of people overseeing the output of what's being generated.
Well, the biggest problem, I guess, in from what I've seen, and we talk a little bit about that one, well, a lot about that one. I run a networking event that takes place on Friday mornings. Feel free to attend if you want to. There's about 100 people now in it, and not all of them show up. We get about 20 people every Friday, and we talk about something called the AI exchange. So this is where people come in and, you know, just share what's working, what's not working. But most of the issues when I hear, oh, AI produces, and I had some guests call it AI slop, and some other people call it, this person told me, AI is like a drunken uncle at a wedding, you know. They say, you know, many bad things, but they may come up with a wisdom. But the fundamental issue, it's in the users. If the user know what they're asking for, what they are doing, and not taking shortcuts, we're able to produce better content, good content out of AI.
Yeah,
and I keep calling it like, when
used well, AI can help you create better quality content. It's so great at like helping you be consistent, making sure that you're staying on brand, using the right terminology and all of that. Like it's completely impossible to have, like the way we worked before is like we have style guides and all these rules and stuff, and we were having to trust people to like follow that, and now like we can run it through AI and be 100% sure that it's been followed, you know, well, 99% sure if it's a good prompt.
Yeah, I was just going to say is that the issue with when it comes to languages is we don't understand the target language in general. Some people do. Most people, 99% of the people don't. And that's why they need to be translated, right? So otherwise they wouldn't need it to be translated. I don't understand Spanish, but if I'm translating into something to Spanish, somehow, somewhere, I need to have checks and balances to know that this Spanish translation is correct. Or if I'm creating content in Spanish, I need to know this is correct. If I don't have any other way of judging it and I'm working alone, solo, I don't have any colleagues that speak Spanish or understand Spanish. So I'm going to just use faith here. And that's the only thing I can hope for, that this is going to be good. Otherwise, we'll find out if I'm in the newspaper next day or not. I have no idea. In a bad way.
Yeah, totally.
So what guardrails do you put in place for the use of AI?
Yeah, I mean, I think like we're all figuring this out, but I think the like most important thing is like having just clear instructions for your team on like how they should use it, when they should use it. And yeah, like we've done trial and error with lots of different things. At the moment, we're using a Claude team account. So basically, like we ask people to work only within our team, like, because this is another thing, if you don't have like an official policy on AI in your company and a tool that you use officially, people are going to unofficially be using it all the time on their own their personal accounts, you know, so it's better to give them the avenue you want them to use. So, and I like think that Claude works well for the team functionality and it being able to have shared projects, being able to like share chat histories and things like across the team so that we are making sure that we're like reusing the useful stuff and that people are like following best practices. And it's something we've been developing over the years and that's pretty much it. Having like really detailed prompts and people knowing when they should be using each prompt, I think is.
Yeah. I'm gonna pause the conversation here for a second. I'll edit this portion. I've got somebody waiting at the door, but I'll cut this out. And I'll come back to you in a second. Just don't go away. I'm very sorry about this one. I had a courier in the door and want my signature. So I apologize and we'll edit that out. No big deal. So let's continue the conversation about AI, because most people right now, they're saying, look, let's talk about the cost for a second, not just the technology, if it works or not. But for most users out there on the client side, they're thinking, look, I mean, it's near zero cost, to be honest, if we use it. And yes, there are some risks in terms of, did I get it right? Is it 100% quality? What I'm constantly hearing through the conversation I've been having on this channel is that, look, may not be 100%, but you can't ignore the cost difference. So people are settling for, you know, I want to say 80% good, 20% not good. And, you know, this is where companies such as yourself, where you're offering much higher quality, higher touch point, you know, you're engaged with the human side of the, you know, the transformation of content. It's, and I know, not, you know, there are several companies such as yourself are really focusing on that high touch point of engagement with customers. You know, it's like I compare it to the, you go to a supermarket to buy your bread versus going to the artisan next door, the bakery who's owned by the family, you know, the kids, you know, the owner, you know, every morning you smell the baking of the bread and you feel like, oh, I just gotta go get that bread. I'm not going to supermarket. I'm gonna buy it directly from the artisan. And is this the type of industry that we're gonna be going with or in the future? You've got two sets of buyers. One buyer is saying automated's fine. The other set of buyers says, nope, I really want to know who translated this. I want to talk to them. I want to meet them, and that's the only way I'm gonna engage with this. Is this where we're going?
I mean, I think that's where we've been for quite a while, like pretty much since like machine translation was invented. But also just like in terms of even before machine translation, like I think that there's always been different types of content that need different levels of attention and different levels of quality. Like there's some things that, you know, like if you're translating, or also like what's important is also different. Like sometimes accuracy is super important for certain types of translations, for example, but the style maybe not as much. In that case, you also might not be able to completely rely on AI because you need a human to check if it's some like an important medical translation or something really technical and or legal, you know, like it has to be checked by a person. But when it comes to, and then you have some things like maybe that's just like a cheap product packaging or something, like I don't know, something that doesn't need as much. Like it needs to be correct, but doesn't have to be amazing. So like good enough is good enough for that. Also some web content, it depends on what it is that you're selling exactly, like how important it is for you, that it's really well adapted and that it reflects your brand and everything. So I think we've always seen people, like clients who value that more than others. And the ones that didn't value that were never our clients. And the ones who do still are, because I and then when it comes to AI too, I don't think it's just like, you know, use it or not. I think like everyone is using AI. It's just like how you're using it. Like for us, it's not about using the AI just to like generate the content and put it out there. It's using AI one to like help automate our processes, using a lot in the back end, making like helping us organize the information, like creating briefs that we can provide and stuff like that, doing things. It really speeds up things on so many levels across the whole production process. But when it comes to making the judgments of like what should be in the content and also like giving the instructions to the AI itself, like the input, the results that you get like vary so widely depending on the quality of your instructions. And I think like people are realizing that like you need to have good people. Like, yes, you should be using AI in most cases. Like it almost doesn't make sense not to, but what you get out of it just is completely is reflective of like what you put in. And so you need really good people putting in that information. And if you're using AI to like create content for a particular market, for example, then you need someone who knows that market, who's prompting the AI, and of course overseeing everything that comes out of it. And I think like with the help of AI, a great writer can do even better work and do it on a much larger scale. So it's like having that expert resource and getting even more out of them, but you still need the expert resource.
I do remember back in the days, for the audience, I'm full of stories on this podcast, right? So every episode I bring you a new story. So this one, I don't think I ever told this story, but you probably need to hear it, I guess. And this goes to the point what Shaheen was talking about, how we started the conversation, that high touch point. There are certain languages where that's a requirement, right? There are some languages that it's not a requirement. It's just everything is commoditized. Press a button, it comes out translated on the other side. Forget about it. I mean, I had somebody who I interviewed on the channel that to argue the point that the contrary point, sorry, that Silicon Valley has said, we've solved the language problem. And everybody else in the language industry say, no, you didn't. But it's a friction point, right? Technologists around the world saying we've solved the language problem. Meanwhile, the industry saying, no, you didn't. And I don't know who's right or who's wrong. All I do here is report the weather for you guys. Now, the story I was going to take you through is that I had a customer, big automotive customer, I won't name any name, based in Japan. And I did a contract with them to do some translation work back when I was young, executive working for a small translation company in Canada. And all I did is I said to the individual, yeah, we'll take your content. We'll give it to one of our translators. They're very good at what they do. They are in country. And they will do the translation for you. And the customer said to me, not too fast. You're going too fast on me here. Slow down. I said, what? They said, we need to meet the translator. Where are they located? Give me their names. Give me their address. I'm going to walk into their office. I'm going to talk to them. I want to see where they come from, which part of Japan they come from. I want to know how they are going to translate. What are they going to translate? What's their... Oh my God, I was dizzy. I said, yeah. You need to know all this before we do the translation. They said, yes. And my ignorance at the time, I didn't know how this thing was done in Japan, how translation was done in Japan. But that validation was needed to happen before we get the translation done. Now, you could say conveniently, that's not convenient for most languages, but doesn't matter. If the customer is asking for this, we have a choice to make. Do we accommodate the customer or do we walk away from the business? If we decide, as Shaheen is doing with her company, that this is an angle that the customer value and there is a space for it in business, well, then you do that. So from your perspective, I guess my question would be, the next question would be is, look, what is can you walk us through a real client situation, you don't have to name them, where you've made a call to create natively rather than adapting from English and made the right call? So what made it the right call? And how did the cost to the client get impacted compared to translation?
I mean, usually like we agree with the client at the outset what the approach is going to be, and we agree on the budget before we get started, of course. So it's not like our own decision.
That's the preferred method, is let's set it up at the front end. But sometimes it doesn't happen that way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there are times though when we've like had where it was basically, it was supposed to be a localization project, but then we realized that it didn't make sense to just localize the content and we needed to basically rewrite it. And so we had to talk about it with the client and reevaluate the budget. Like that happened with a real estate company we were working with that was doing landlord content like for different international markets in Europe. And it was just so different, like the regulations and everything, that didn't make sense. We couldn't just translate the articles. Like we had to re-research them and like come up with also different local angles that made sense, considering like the local context. So that's kind of one example that comes to mind.
So did the customer was surprised by this or?
No, it was easy to convince them. And I would say the cost wasn't like insanely different. how we priced it, but
it wasn't insanely different. It was like increment, a little bit of an added cost, but it wasn't like, you know, crazy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, maybe it was 30% more to write it instead of translate it. So it was worth it.
So from, you know, from my perspective, like I've been doing this for like almost 30 years now. The word localization has been stretched too thin right now, I think, in terms, to some extent, starts to lose a little bit of a meaning in my case, just from where I'm sitting right now and having as many conversations we're having. Some people use it like for post-editing, like MT pass. So we just push everything through content and we do a little bit of a post-editing on it. And then in some others, perhaps I've interviewed a couple of people who talk about full cultural transformation. Basically, a content needs to meet not just the translation piece, you know, word per word, but it needs to meet certain cultural expectation for the demographic that we're going to destine or that we're going to target this content to. On this particular spectrum, from post-editing to cultural transformation, where does Vera Content sits right now? And where do you think the industry needs perhaps a new vocabulary? Do we need to call it something different?
Good question. I haven't heard a cultural transformation used in this context, but I like it. actually, when we were talking about the like when to localize versus write, I thought of another example, because basically when we do social media projects, we actually don't differentiate the price based on, like, because we basically charge, like based on volume to some degree. So it's and the nature of the project. But like we say, we're doing this mini posts, and basically we agree on the calendar. Some of those posts might be adapted from existing content you have. A lot of times we'll use like the same visual assets and stuff. But if we need to, if we decide to translate it or completely rewrite it, like we don't actually charge differently for that, because in the end, the amount of when it comes to those kinds of projects, there's so much. The writing isn't even like the most time consuming part, so it doesn't impact the overall budget that much. And if it's better to rewrite it, then we'll just rewrite it. So I think, yeah, I don't know if this goes hand in hand with the cultural transformation part, but I think I mean, these are the kinds of projects we really like to do, is like the ones that like are really like, you know, creating content for that local market and really like getting to know the market and being involved in like those conversations with people in the market too. Like the social media projects are cool because we actually like get to see the reaction of how people react to the content, like the way they comment and engage with it. And engaging with them back. So we work on content strategies, like comment strategies as well. So, yeah.
And do you, like, where do you sit on the MT post edit stuff? Do you use MT at all or no?
We do use cat software that has like MT like built in. So we do available like for our translators to use as a reference. So, but yeah.
Is that something you bought or something you built?
No, it's third party. We use Phrase.
We use Phrase, okay, yeah. And this is much probably a bit of a higher level discussion or more visionary vision discussion. Do you think companies such as Phrase, Trados, MemoQ, all these guys, is there still space for that down the road? I mean, if you look down 5 years down the road from an AI perspective now, and especially on that whole SaaS software model. From everybody I talked to, they're telling me that the SaaS model is collapsing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we are very good Phrase customers and we use them more and more. So I don't know about other agencies, but but I find, yeah, that it's still super needed. I mean, just to deal with like all the different file types and everything, like, and also that, like, I think, I don't know about the other platforms, but Phrase has been really good about implementing AI into their, like giving you AI suggestions and things within the software and stuff. So I feel like they're very on top of the trends and continue to be very relevant.
Well, good to hear, because that's a different opinion that I'm hearing, but that's encouraging, at least for, you know, the many TMSs that we have in the industry. Small industry with 200 TMSs in it. And now everybody creating their own TMS. I met, and I'm not kidding.
People can build their own anything they want now with like the AI coding.
I met a brand new company. Where was I based out of? I can't remember. Germany, I think, or somewhere. They were telling me about this new TMS software that they built. And I saw a demo of it. And I said, so how are you going to charge for this? It's nothing, Robin. Just like cheaper than what you pay for your Netflix. I said, oh, okay, well, this is pretty cool, guys. Who's going to buy it? Now, the point I was trying to make on TMS is anybody can build their own software right now, right? So you can build subset of what you need, or you can build a full-fledged TMS with all its bells and whistles. But if I can put a software together on Saturday afternoon using, you know, normal, small AI tools, I'm assuming somebody who's got a little bit more resources can put together any software they want. With relatively short time. And that's where I was going with this one, build versus buy, create, you know, I mean, here's a small example. A lot of people use right now email tools to send emails to their customers, outreach, whatever, keep contacts with their databases, etc. And use various online software for that. You know, use your CRM, use a bunch of things. You know, I've written my own.
Maybe, but like the cat part, like the actual computer assisted translation, like that part I think would be difficult to build, like the management, sure, but like I don't know, I personally I'm not going to build that.
I'm not pro or against, but I can tell you one thing, I'm a data guy. That's where my background is. Data is where the TMS was where data go to die, and AI where data get actualized. This is where, you know, if you use AI to its full extent, this is where AI go, you know, the data goes to be alive, to be activated, to be used in a variety of way, in a variety of context. And the typical example from a TMS perspective, unless if it gets queried, that data is not getting engaged. In AI, when you build it and you feed it to the model, then it learns from it, it behaves, it adapts, etc. So On the, you know, I don't want to solve the entire TMS issue right now, but on the, it's worth having a conversation about it at some point. But what's your read right now where brand side buyers are in 2026? Are they getting smarter about the difference between cheap AI generated multilingual content or genuinely localized content? Are they getting educated on this? And what do you think their behavior look like?
I mean, I definitely think like across the board, everyone has finally like clicked, because I feel like there's a lot of people who just were like business as usual, like weren't jumping to adapt to AI. And I know like as soon, like it's been 4 years now that like ChatGPT has been on the market. And so I think when that first came out, everyone was like, anyone who's in this industry was like, oh crap, this is going to change everything. Like, but we were like waiting for it to come, and it came like way later than I expected. Like, I think like for a lot of like large corporates, it's difficult for them to like change their internal processes. And a lot of them are even now are still doing this things the old way, like having just even some of our clients like don't have permission to, like they're not allowed to do anything with AI in their company. Like, and it's only like recently that it's like, oh, maybe the IT department will let us use ChatGPT. So and I feel like, you know, if it's not broken, like, don't fix it, right? It's like, if a process is working, sometimes in these big companies, they're just like, we're just going to keep doing it as it is.
Unless you have to.
Yeah. But I do think finally, pretty much everyone has realized, okay, we need to be using AI in some way. And the attitudes about it, like, really vary very widely depending on the person. And depending on the company and the culture of the company and stuff. Because we have some clients who just are like, okay, we need to be using AI for everything. Like, we want to have more oversight into the processes you guys are using. We want to, and so, and then these are more like, I'd say more tech advanced companies. Who want to work with us to optimize, or who decide to internalize completely, which we've seen in some cases. And then we have others who are slower to it, or weary still of AI, who are like, they don't want AI used at all in anything. And that's also not, doesn't make a lot of sense.
Speaking of AI in Europe, is there different rules in Europe to use AI than it is in North America, specifically around the data used to train AI? Do you see like a little bit of a difference in terms of regulation?
I trust that the AI platforms are following.
Yeah, that's right. Are they following the rules or not? It's up to them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're not using it for, like, generally we're using AI either for our own processes or for like production of content creation that's going to be published publicly. So we're not usually dealing with like any like sensitive information. But definitely like Europe tends to be stricter about these things than the US.
So for Vera Content, what's next for you? What's the vision here?
Yeah, well, I think I talked a little bit about how we are just really focusing on content strategy and those like up the chain services when it comes to advising clients on SEO, helping them manage their email marketing and automation and social media. So I think also, like I mentioned, that's an area that we are excited about and like have had a lot of growth in is like local community management and localized content creation. Also working with local content creators in the different international markets, creating social video for social media as well. So this is some of the areas we're growing in. And I think that we've been in a good position in this whole transition. Of course, we've been very impacted by the AI shift. But like I said, we were already positioning ourselves as a marketing company. So we really just lent into that and like taken on a lot more of these marketing strategy projects. And I think being we're a small boutique agency, like we're adaptable. So we've really been listening to our clients and adapting to what they need in these changing times.
What would you say to, you know, the listeners who are right now, some of them are possible to be, you know, down the road maybe, or existing clients of yours right now? Why would they come to you? Like, what would make Vera Content to be their choice? Maybe you can excite them a little bit here in terms of selecting Vera Content as their supplier of choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you're looking for a supplier who really gets to know your brand, who will sit down with you, who will you get to know who are the people actually working on your project, like dealing with real people, not just a dispatcher, then we could be the agency for you.
And you know, for the audience, you know, of course, you always have the choice to create in English and translate. And I come from that industry. I worked in that industry for 20, 30 years. Now, if you are okay with that, then go ahead and do that. But if you want to set yourself a little bit bar, a little higher in terms of you've got an important product, you've got an important meeting, you've got an important market that you want to chase, and you want to look presentable, not commoditized, not, the cheapest on the block kind of a product or service. You want to put out a strong image for your company, for your product, for whatever you're trying to do, commercialize internally or externally. And that goes internally, externally, guys, not necessarily just a product, right? So even if you have employees or you have a human resources department that you're running internal training, you're running health and safety stuff internally, that needs to be also considered. You cannot just go to the cheapest route of commercializing your content. You need to be actually taking a look at this from a different angle, okay? If you are, let's say, a product that you don't care too much, you have, like IKEA, you have pictorial stuff, you don't have a lot of words in your user manual, you can do whatever you want, I guess, in that case. But if you want to have a product content that matches your product in terms of quality, you may want to take a look at elevating your content from it being translated to creating the content directly into the language of your target audience. It's very important. And I'm saying this with all due respect to all my colleagues in the language industry. I love you all. But based on where we are right now, based on the tech that we are in right now, based on what I've seen in my life in the language industry, it doesn't always hit the mark. And, for some reason or another, I mean, here's an example. We're talking to Shaheen this morning. I asked her first question. You created the company because you were on the buyer side out of frustration. How many of those stories we've heard so far? And I can name like 20 right now. I don't want to take the entire hour reciting them. I won't. Many companies out there started because of frustration with the industry, did not deliver what they're looking for, either on time, on quality, at cost. Many reasons that this industry has boxed itself in one solution and we never evolved. And what forced us to evolve were outside factors, either technologies or customers, one or the others. And I've interviewed many people on the client side on this channel, and I could reference all these episodes for you to reference, or you can do research on the channel and look them up yourself. It is a valid concern. The industry has not yet managed to, position itself in a way to accommodate this. Most people, they built a process and they stick to a process. I work for the largest localization company in the world, and it's a process. You put the content in top of the process, it comes out translated at the bottom, at the end of the process. That's it. What happened in between? Did we get the right terminology? Did we not get the right style guide? Did we achieve 100% quality? Not always. Hit and miss, guys. It's not always. It's not guaranteed. There is nobody can guarantee you 100% quality. Ask.
And I think even some of our clients do work with other agencies for more routine content. Like, we're very much like working on the content, the priority content that's going to be like the most visible, that's going to be, on the editorial channels. So
no,
there's still validity in the old model as well. But I do think it's been more impacted by AI because there's so much more automation there.
What would you say to the localization industry? What do they need to change? I mean, you've straddled almost both localization industry and your part of the content. What would you say to the localization industry?
I mean, I think we just have to be adaptable. Like I said, I think it's probably harder for the larger firms to adapt because they have very established processes. They have huge teams. So retraining people and adapting the whole way of doing things, it's got to be a lot harder. But I think right now it's like adapt or die.
But for you, like, you work for a boutique agency or you have a boutique agency, and you mentioned that up front, it means that you can move things pretty fast. If you see a customer requirement, you can make a decision. Do I do this or not? You don't have to go through the corporate ladder. I'm talking about the mid-sized companies to large companies in the localization industry. A lot of constraints are around bureaucracies inside of their processes. And most CEOs in these companies are screaming from the top of their lungs, simplification. I don't believe it because I think there's a book I'm going to write at one point. The way to complicate things in the localization industry, I think they can write a few books on the topic of how do we complicate things. Take a simple thing, which is take a content from one language, put it in another language. From the outside, it looks pretty easy. You translate. However, we perfected the art of sort of like the obstacle course, if you will, if somebody's running an obstacle course, just to the nth degree of how many ways we can make sure that we are putting some obstacles in the process. And some of these obstacles are correct. We need to put them in place, checks and balances, whatever you want to call them, instead of calling them obstacles. But some of them are unnecessary and it's causing customer frustration, as you mentioned.
Yeah, it was something interesting that we did that I think that a lot of larger companies can do are probably also doing, but is like now that it's so easy to build things with AI and like you, it's something that can like empower your team to like come up with solutions on their own. And that's something we did was have like an internal kind of challenge, kind of hackathon to like build automations using AI to see like, and it was really cool to see like what people came up with to like improve their own processes, that some of them were really relevant for the rest of the team. And I'm sure big companies are doing this too. Like, I think I've heard of like Transperfect doing something like this with their internal team, like a innovation initiatives and even like launching
some. Well, everybody's doing innovation initiatives. I mean, the flavor of the day. I mean, I hear it in big companies, I hear it in small companies. We have to move to AI. Okay, so how do you do that? You can't just say we have to move to AI. What are the applications you're building? What problem are you trying to solve? And you know, as I talk about it on this channel, like till I blew in the face, is you cannot put AI on top of a bad process. It's going to amplify how bad your process is. You have to go back and look at the internal processes you have, and in comparison or in consideration of the new technology, and say, do I still need this antiquated process? Yes or no? And if you don't, then you have to remove it first and then layer technology on top of it. Redesign the process first and then layer technology on top of it. You put technology on top of a bad process. It worked till now, but it may not work in the future. It may not work at all. It will probably, exasperate the problem. It will exaggerate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Now, as we come to an end of our conversation here, what does the 2028 look for you, to you right now? If you were to say, well, I'm going to look down to 2028 and I say, create natively versus transform debate. Has been settled by then or what?
I'm not sure, but I definitely see a lot of work in 2028. Like, I definitely think that things are changing, but there's like more work to do than ever. And whoever adapts well is, you know, will have a lot to do. Like, there's a lot to do and a lot of money to be made, I think, for whoever figures this out. Because it's just, I think everyone like needs to change their processes to adapt to AI, but they're creating more content than ever before. So like the amount of content that's been created has just like proliferated. There's so much work to do on like making sure it's good, editing it, like giving direction on how to do it. So the work has completely changed. Like, it is a totally different job than what we were doing 10 years ago, but there's a lot of work to do. So
there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. So I see ourselves adapting to this successfully and growing over the next years, but it's growing in an area in directions that we hadn't expected, basically. But it's exciting. I'm excited about where it will take us.
Excellent. And if you had to leave every localization and content professional listening to this conversation today with one thing they should do differently on Monday morning, what would that be?
Ooh. I needed a warning of this question.
Stop drinking coffee. Drink your shakes. Take a deep breath. Do yoga in the morning.
Well, I would say like right now, it's like with all the tools, AI tools and things that are available, it can be really overwhelming. So I guess my advice would just be to take one thing at a time and work on one little thing that you can improve and don't get overwhelmed.
And where can people find you and follow Vera Content right now and listen to Content Mix or the rebrand Global Marketer, I guess?
Exactly, the Global Marketer. The website is veracontent.com and you can find me on LinkedIn, Shaheen Samavadi.
Absolutely. And is there anything else you'd like to tell the audience before we wrap it up?
I don't think so. I think we've covered it all.
You know, I love it. You know, you come into the conversation, you and I, and we're all going to have a few laughs and educating a few people in the process. I had fun with this one. Did you?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a great conversation.
Excellent. And if I missed anything, I'm sure you'll send it to me via email. And we'll update the audience when I publish the episode. You should expect that in the next few days. And for everybody, I want to thank you so much for joining me and Shaheen Samavati, CEO of Vera Content. And I love you guys for listening in on to our channel. If you're coming into our YouTube channel, thanks for watching us. And if you're watching, if you're listening in on our audio channels, thanks for listening in. And if you're reading the blog post on robinayoub.blog, thanks for checking us out. And by the way, as I mentioned during our recording, we do have an app where you can find all the content in one place on your phone app. So that's app.l10nfiresidechat.com, all one word, l10nfiresidechat.com. So app.l10nfiresidechat.com. So with this note, I want to thank you all for listening in to our conversation, and I will see you guys at the next episode.